I'm Eric Severide. I'm not an authority on Asia. Asia is far too big, changing far too rapidly for many certainties. I'm not an expert on war. There is no such thing as military science. War is a rude art in which human character, will, and faith play at least as great a role as figures and logic. About truth, I hope I know more. It is a reporter's business to tell appearance from reality, rhetoric from fact. He often fails. In this Vietnam War, he fails unusually often because he is normally a stranger to the land, its language, and its people. And because at every level, military, political, economic, psychological, the truth is fragmented in a thousand pieces. At each level, it is a jigsaw puzzle that no single man is able to piece together. We are therefore confronted with an extraordinary condition. No honest man can return a convincing answer to the great and obvious questions that all men ask. Is our action there insurance against eventual war with China, as the administration asserts, or is it increasing the risk of such a war? Will the Vietnamese pull themselves together politically or fall further apart? Are we winning this war? Do we have a clear strategy for winning it? How many years and men will it take? To each question, the official rhetoric of Washington gives the optimistic response. These officials speak from faith, not fact. The total of the known facts does not deny their optimism, but it does not confirm it either. Through this fog of uncertainties, the reporter must pick his way. He must report out of instinct, experience, and impression. He can guess, estimate, and try to project what seem to him the probabilities. And his first task is to break through the crust of his own preconceived notions. I think I was only dimly aware of what the American power in the Pacific world really means. As you fly the great arcs to Alaska and Japan and down the eastern rim of Asia's landmass, you begin to understand. The vast Pacific and the skies above it belong to American power. America, its men, money, and machines, is intermingled with the affairs of governments everywhere, the daily lives of hundreds of millions of people. Consider the world of the Pacific Ocean and the Southern Seas in this American era. Alaska, 30,000 military men. Hawaii, 100,000 military men. Guam, 20,000. Okinawa, 25,000. Japan, 39,000. Korea, 55,000. Taiwan, 10,000. The Philippines, 25,000. Vietnam, about 285,000. Thailand, 20,000. Besides, of course, the 7th Fleet itself, 60,000 to 70,000 men. This is a legacy of the defeat of Japan in World War II, of the takeover of China by the Communists, of the collapse of European rule, of the Korean War, and now of the fighting in Vietnam. It is also the legacy of habit, of the military man's fear of ever giving up any salient, and of the idea that Communist China is bent upon military aggression, as were Hitler's Germany and Stalin's Russia. There's a strange phenomenon that comes into play in the relationship between impressions and reality. It has to do with time and space. For distance lends not only enchantment, but apprehension. So to Americans at home, the Buddhist riots in Saigon mean that all Saigon is in turmoil. But the man sitting in a cafe a block from the riots is relaxed. He knows it's not. So to us at home, China appears a frightening monster, straining at the leash, eager to smash her neighbors. But some of her neighbors are far more relaxed than we. They believe that China is already contained. She is contained by the existence of the nuclear bomb, by the simple knowledge that if she marches over the border of a friendly country that we are able to help, we shall immediately help. She is contained by this gigantic ring of steel built by the United States along her eastern and southern borders, and by Russia's ring of steel along 4,000 miles of her western border. If she feels encircled, no big power ever had more right to feel that way. She fears what the United States may do more than some of her neighbors fear what she may do. China can try the methods of subversion in Southeast Asia. She has and she does. But it is doubtful how successful she would be even without our presence and resistance in Vietnam. Nationalism is basically stronger than any ideology. Most nations are not dominoes that fall over with a click. These nations of Southeast Asia, like Thailand or Burma, are more like sponges. Their edges can become waterlogged with communist-trained resistance groups, but there are 1,000 natural obstacles to the water seeping through the whole organism. One is the historic dislike and distrust of the Chinese throughout these regions. A crucial question, whether our resistance in Vietnam is preventing the spread of Chinese dominance in other Asian countries through their propaganda, infiltration, and subversion. The administration points to Indonesia, where the powerful Chinese-inspired communist apparatus was smashed not long ago. That would never have happened, they like to think, were we not there in Vietnam. If this is true, all of us would feel very much better about this war in Vietnam. My personal opinion is that it's not true. Indeed, it was a conclusion of Japan's ambassadors to Southeast Asian countries in recent consultation that Vietnam had nothing to do with those events in Indonesia, that internal domestic pressures alone were responsible. Korea in the north and Thailand in the south are the exceptions to this line of thought. The men who rule Thailand have thrown in their lot with the United States and its argument, contrary to Burma on their west and Cambodia on their east. They do fear China and communism in general, and they have given welcome and facilities to American power. The Thai government tries to keep as much of this secret as it can, and we help them in this out of diplomatic considerations. But the truth is that we have upwards of 20,000 military men in Thailand, mostly on the great bomber bases from which we hit North Vietnam and the Ho Chi Minh trails. Reporters are not permitted to see these bases. 20,000 is more men than we had in Vietnam itself when Mr. Johnson became the president. Our military wanted at one time to put ground combat units into northeast Thailand where skirmishes go on with Chinese-trained guerrillas. Our diplomats stopped that, but we have more than a few special forces advisory fighting teams in the northeast. And there one sees how war tends to spread and of why military men must be kept in constant check by political men. Laos, technically neutral by the Geneva Agreements, is thoroughly engulfed in the war already. The North Vietnamese run their supplies and fresh soldiers through much of Laos, and therefore we bomb it constantly. We admit to no men on the ground in Laos. My information from people I consider reliable is that we have several thousand soldiers inside Laos, including spotter groups and special forces teams. When an American is killed in or over Laos, his death is officially registered as having occurred in Vietnam. Cambodia is becoming more and more deeply involved in the fighting. We have bombed and shelled Cambodian territory more than once for some time back because we have had to. I believe our frontline intelligence reports and our eyewitnesses. When General Larson, commander of our Second Corps, whose boundaries lie along the Cambodian border, said there are heavy North Vietnamese troop concentrations inside Cambodia, I am inclined to believe him rather than the Pentagon's immediate denial of this. After all, he is on the scene. This, then, is how war spreads, in spite of all the official proclamations that we shall not allow it to spread. War has a logic, a momentum, imperatives of its own. And in this process, language is adulterated, reason twisted, policy follows in the wake of actions instead of the other way around, and the inner sequence of cause and effect is lost to man's comprehension. So the administration argues that unless we stop communism or China or both in Vietnam now, other nations will fall, as happened in Europe in the 30s, until a grand confrontation of World War III with China will be forced upon the world. It seems to me that it's quite as logical to argue that our very presence in Vietnam, with this inevitable osmotic spread of hostilities across other borders, is just as likely to produce war with China, unless we are extremely careful and extremely lucky. And if that happens, it will be like World War I, if not World War II. Men still argue how World War I got started, as actions led to reactions and still further reactions, engulfing nation by nation. And if we are sucked into collision with China in these regions, we will never be sure of the precise point in space or time when it happened. How the Vietnam War goes will be the test of all this. Vietnam is the anvil on which our future relations with vast emerging China are being hammered out, and the sparks fly in all directions. Until we got into it, the Vietnam War was essentially a civil war and a social revolution and a struggle for national identity and freedom from European rule. For legal and diplomatic reasons, Washington must argue that it is not a civil war at all, but an aggression and an invasion by an external power. But when men speaking the same language, living within the same cultural context, raised in the same cities and villages, fight one another by the thousands, that is civil war. When men of the North, including Prime Minister Key, are part of the government of the South and vice versa, it's civil war. Even the Geneva Agreements called the two zones of the one country, not sovereign states. North Vietnam has gone to the Chinese weapon system. Their material help from China and Russia is considerable. But no Chinese officer or soldier has ever been found among the enemy's fighting cadres, to my knowledge. It is the apparent conviction of Washington that if North Vietnam will just stop its infiltration into the South, the war could be settled. Not necessarily, not unless Hanoi also ordered a ceasefire all down the line. One of our leading generals there argues strongly that the units from the North need the local guerrillas far more than the guerrillas need them. The guerrillas are home. They need ammunition, but not trucks or oil or great depots of rice. How many men are coming down from the North? Last fall, Secretary McNamara said it was 4,500 a month. This April, we were told in Saigon that it had gone higher, might reach 7,000. The other day, the Pentagon again said 4,500. These figures are educated guesses, no more. How many in all have come down? At the Saigon headquarters, you are told there are, at a generous estimate, 50 battalions of North Vietnamese now in the South. Their battalions are far smaller than ours, perhaps 400 or 500 men. That means about 25,000 Northerners in their own combat units. And that, in turn, is only 10% of the estimated total of 250,000 organized and semi-organized fighting men that we in the South Vietnamese now face. On both sides, it's a much bigger war than a year ago when it was nearly lost and when President Johnson ordered the massive infusions of American troops. Our intelligence people out there believe that the enemy is now better armed man for man than our South Vietnamese allies, far worse armed, of course, than we. Our fighting men, our weapons and devices, our tactical ingenuity, all are profoundly impressive. We could not fight this war at all were it not our side that enjoys the real privileged sanctuaries, the sea and the sky. Both are denied to the enemy. If our tactics are ingenious, our grand strategy remains a mystery, at least to me. We are fighting what is essentially a war of attrition, the most disagreeable kind of war, counting progress by the number of enemy bodies. The count is accurate when our men can actually go among the bodies. When the Air Force claims so many Viet Cong killed from bombing and strafing runs, those are foolish guesses. The claims of enemy killed by the South Vietnamese forces and the figures on their own casualties may be approximately right or wildly wrong. None of us can really check. It might be better if we in the news business reported weekly progress in terms of hamlets restored or resettled, classrooms built, village chiefs who feel it safe to go back and sleep in their own houses. That, after all, is what the war is about. And in this respect, there is progress. It is something to see tough American Marines acting as dedicated social workers. It is a fact worth knowing that of the 3,000 Marines who have voluntarily extended their term of duty in Vietnam, most are those men who work daily with the ordinary people. Progress, but painfully slow progress. And against it must be set the great numbers of refugees who come into our secured areas, about 1 million of them now. And not all of them by any means fleeing from Viet Cong terror. Many fleeing from the terror of our napalm and high explosives, which have inescapably killed and maimed hundreds of innocent people. We are not really conquering territory. Our official statement is that at the end of last year, 8.5% of the total land area was considered secure. At the end of February, 9.5%. All the rest is in enemy hands or disputed and unsafe or empty. About 8 million people, a bit over half the population, are in secure Allied-controlled areas. We are using giant sledgehammers to kill hornets. The Viet Cong's National Liberation Front in the South has an annual budget estimated at about $10 million. Our annual costs in this war run to about $15 billion. In terms of last year's total expenditure for the war, each enemy soldier killed last year cost us well over $1 million. What of our human investment and human losses? Of the total American military in country, say 285,000, only a distinct minority do the real fighting on the ground and in the air. They alone are the heroes. All the rest in the enormous support and supply echelons in the cities and ports, in the countless offices, they may occasionally court danger, but their life is wholly different, usually comfortable, for a great many enjoyable. We had, when I left, 5 combat divisions and 2 brigades in the field, around 85,000 men. Add to that the special forces teams and the combat flyers. Of these, I would guess generously that about 60,000 can be defined as men in frequent combat. Now, this is an arbitrary definition, but necessary, some definitions necessary, if we are to think at all about our human investment and losses. And thinking from this rough definition, one feels obliged to say that our casualties are high, not low. They are low in relation to the total number in Vietnam, mostly men who never or rarely ever see the enemy, and low compared to enemy losses. But our losses in combat dead and wounded have mounted rapidly to the current rate of about 30,000 a year. 1 year is a man's term of service there. On the simple statistical face of it, then, the chances for the individual fighting soldier in an active combat zone avoiding death or wounds in his 12 months are not great, about 50-50. What lengthens his odds is the increasing rotation of more units, not just between home and Vietnam, but between the fighting zones and the rest zones. And if enemy attacks slacken off, that, of course, will improve the odds. For every man admitted to hospital in Vietnam for combat wounds, 3 times as many are admitted for non-combat injuries and disease. In terms of the combat troops, one is then forced to the conclusion that we lose the equivalent of about a battalion a week, most of them, of course, to return later on. But this is a rather constant process, and the need for more men and more rotation in combat operations would seem obvious. In this sense, our casualties are high, not low. And by the other relevant measuring rod, the lasting gain from the average combat operation, some Viet Cong killed, some rice destroyed, a village cleaned out, much of which the enemy will later replace and recover, by this measure, too, the casualties must be considered high, not low. Last summer began the big increase in the American fighting force. So this summer, tens of thousands of men will leave Vietnam, but they will be replaced, these veterans, by green troops. However good their training at home, all soldiers are green until they have gone through at least one real battle. And greenness does cost lives. One green company of my acquaintance recently lost 130 men killed and badly wounded out of its 170 in one engagement. In the official handout later, the casualties of that action were described as moderate, presumably because other units were also involved or because the enemy lost even more. The phrase heavy casualties I don't think I ever saw in those handout statistics. I do not believe we are losing this war or will lose it. I am not sure one can call it a stalemate, as some men do. The Viet Cong in the south and those units from the north are getting badly hurt. That is why the Viet Cong is now recruiting kids as young as 13 from their homes in the south, taxing the people more heavily, and thus losing some of their popular support. That is why some of those northern units are not at all well trained. That is why those who desert to the other side are nearly all the enemy fighters, not South Vietnamese or, of course, Americans. Hanoi may have to call it off, though we see no signs yet that it will. It is a test of political will. But like some others, when I try to envisage the process of winning, I am haunted by a specter. The specter of this fragmentized, weary Vietnamese society. It was our official belief and the argument among many of the so-called hawks that as we stopped losing this war, which we've done, and as we started winning it, which we've not quite done, the bitterly conflicting political and social factions in South Vietnam would start to pull together in their national interest. The trouble is that Vietnam is only a society, not a nation. There is not a single leader of countrywide prestige in South Vietnam. The people have had little experience in responding to general laws and impersonal institutions. They respond to local personalities, cliques, religious groupings, or their own private interest. The resistance and rioting of the most militant Buddhists seems to mean that they hate the central government more than they hate the communist enemy. We try to apply Western logic and experience to this Oriental land, so we encourage the elections, envisage a parliament and eventual civilian rule representing groups and regions. My own guess is that this process of democratizing would produce years of political turmoil before stability is reached. It will probably, though not certainly, open a whole new Pandora's box, all the quarrels in the country bursting into the open. Vietnam, I think myself, is not to be compared with Korea or Greece, where we were successful in these respects. A strong national sense and strong leaders existed in those countries. If this proves to be the trend as we try to democratize government in Vietnam, then the immediate consequence would be a nightmare for us, for we should then have to involve ourselves deeper and deeper into their politics, their economy, and more of the fighting and dying would be done by Americans and less by the Vietnamese. 10 days ago, Secretary McNamara asserted that Vietnamese politics would not hinder our war effort there. It is part of the duty of national leaders to speak from their faith, not from their fears. But it is part of the duty of the press to examine their faith, to raise the questions that officials never publicly raise. The hypothetical alternatives in Vietnam remain about what they were. Bomb more of North Vietnam's industry and see what happens while nervously watching nervous China. Halt the bombing and pull back to our base areas and see what happens. Encourage the various Third Nation efforts to get negotiations started. Quit Vietnam entirely. Keep the pressure on, as we are doing, and wait for Hanoi's will to break. As of now, the prospect is more pressure, more and heavier war. That is the meaning of the stepped-up draft, the new troop shipments, the longer lanes of cargo vessels plowing the South China Sea, the increasing roar of the airplanes settling onto those ever-increasing airfields. I should like to mention, before I end this long and not very happy discourse, two matters, a bit cosmic perhaps, but of fundamental consequence for our future affairs. One is the fantastic size of our military establishment and the fantastic speed by which its cost increases. This can consume our marginal substance. This is what General Eisenhower warned about in his last words as president. He said we must guard against undue power by a military-industrial complex. It will take a very convincing peace and a very strong president to put our military genie back in the bottle. The other thing is this, that the deepest, strongest forces motivating the people of Asia are not those we picture as we sit here at home. From here, one has the illusion that Asia is clanking armies, colliding ideologies, aggression and fear, that Asia is politics. But the deepest forces moving Asian people now are not these at all, but the forces of the modern scientific industrial revolution. Asians have discovered the great secret so long hidden from their hope, that man is not born to a short life of pain and work and poverty. They see the marvelous evidence nearly everywhere they look. Japan, a booming economic colossus whose production may soon pass Great Britain's. Korea, prosperous enough to do without direct American aid. Taiwan, where food production has doubled in 15 years and where new hotels, highways, factories open every month. Thailand, whose cities boom and grow. Indonesia, which has stopped its ridiculous war with Malaysia and now wants to join the real procession. Even communist China, where basic comfort now seems assured for most and where a new generation of economists, engineers, builders is slowly but surely coming to replace the old men of politics and war as they were replaced in Russia when Stalin died. In Taiwan, I had a Chinese driver named Jimmy, a mainlander who had to flee the Chinese communists and has no love for them at all. But he said to me, if only America and China can learn to get along, what a wonderful thing for us all. Jimmy perceives what Asia and life can be. Our government perceives it, as attested by the Johnson plans for Southeast Asia's economic development. But if this war in Vietnam goes wrong and the great collision does come, all this will be lost. And that would break history's heart. This reporter, like most, even among those who fear and doubt, still believes that God and the stars will again indulge their notorious weakness for Americans and bring us through this unhappy Vietnamese transaction in safety and peace. And there, like the government officials, I speak from faith, not from the facts, knowing as they know that faith, even blind faith, can sometimes change the facts. This is Eric Severide in New York. Good evening.
Vietnam, Eric Severide's personal report, has been presented by CBS News as part of its continuing coverage of the Vietnam conflict. This broadcast was produced under the supervision and control of CBS News.
This is the CBS Radio Network.